Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Michael David Lucas, author of the book Last Watchman of Old Cairo, and recipient of the Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinchiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This coming Saturday night, we will celebrate the major but often forgotten Jewish holiday of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks. Shavuot, or Shavuos, celebrates the receiving of the Ten Commandments at Sinai and concludes a process of counting the 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuot, the period of the counting of the Omer. Shavuot is called Chag HaBikurim, the holiday of first fruits, falling as it does in late spring slash early summer, when the very first crops of the summer begin to ripen in hot climates like Israel or Tucson, Arizona, where I live. It's a shame so many Jews ignore Shavuot because this festival, which begins Saturday night, continuing through Sunday, is important. It was on Shavuot, according to Jewish tradition, the greatest human interaction with God in all of history actually took place. At this time of year, about 3,200 years ago, we received the Ten Commandments in dramatic fashion. In the book of Exodus, the commandments are given with lightning, thunder, smoke, fire, and an earthquake, and the blasts of the shofar ringing out in the desert air. And out of all that tumult, God's voice clearly conveyed a great message of morality and ethics that includes the Ten Commandments. Without Shavuot, we don't have the Torah. Without the Torah, we don't have Judaism. And of course, if we don't have Judaism, we would never have had Christianity or Islam or Western civilization at all. So Shavuot or Shavuos matters very much. Since we received Torah, in the broader sense of the word, on this festival, the tradition is that after evening services Saturday night, they are at 8 p.m. at my own temple, Congregation Beit Simcha, we move to tables and have a guided program of study of Jewish ideas, issues, and texts for the rest of the night, concluding with the saying of morning prayers at dawn the next day. To keep us fortified, we eat only dairy foods, since, according to Midrash, rabbinic legend, at the time when the Ten Commandments were given, all human beings stood at Mount Sinai and listened with their full attention. But so did all the animals present. And if animals could hear God's word given aloud, it seems inappropriate to eat them on the anniversary of that experience. From that clever little Midrashic tale came the tradition of having dessert all night, a really nice practice if you ask me, and from that came the custom of fueling our late night studies with cheesecake, one of the most Jewish of all desserts. And so, my own congregation hosts a cheesecake celebration in which we sample a rich and delicious array of the best of our community's sweets, sugar and caffeine blending to inspire us all to continue to learn Torah. This makes Shavuot quite literally the sweetest of all Jewish holidays. It's coming this Saturday night, June 8th, 8 p.m. at Congregation Beit Simcha. Shavuot morning Yisker services are Sunday, June 9th. Don't miss it. Here's a musical introduction on the subject of Mount Sinai. From the great ensemble, the Boston Camerata, a song to Moses, Mi al Har Chorev, literally, who on Mount Sinai spoke to God face to face.
Bardin di getri male
That was me, Al Har Chorev, for the holiday of Shavuot, Shavuos, this coming Saturday night and Sunday. Our Tikkun Leil Shavuot, the study session for the evening of Shavuot with cheesecake celebration, will be at my synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, beginning at 8 p.m. Saturday night. I've spent only one Shavuos in Jerusalem, and the way you conclude the evening of study is by walking to the Western Wall, the Kotel, at dawn there. Thousands of contemporary pilgrims imitating the processions of the days when the temple stood in Jerusalem. It's an amazing experience, never to be forgotten. A reminder of the power and beauty of these days that celebrate something much greater than our own small lives, yet with the ability to bring us into inspiring contact with something much greater than ourselves. A really good thing. You should try it at least once. Our guest this morning is Michael David Lucas, author of The Last Watchman of Old Cairo, which recently won the Rohr Jewish Literature Prize, most lucrative and prestigious award available for new Jewish fiction. Meet the writer of this fascinating and beautiful book. We're going to return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Michael David Lucas is the recipient of the Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature, which is a big deal. His book is called, most recent book is called The Last Watchman of Old Cairo, a fascinating and enjoyable read. And well, we'll hear more about it from him. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish and Mazel Tov.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So some of us have known an awful lot about the Cairo Geniza without ever thinking it would make for a good novel. Tell us what led you to this.
I think that the kind of, you know, seed that I keep coming back to, you know, every novel has multiple seeds, but the one that seems most kind of obvious is I was living in Cairo, I was living in Cairo right around the year 2000, and I was studying Arabic there, studying abroad, and, you know, if you've ever been to the city, it's this kind of sublime, decrepit,
overwhelming,
ultra-friendly, welcoming, phenomenal, beautiful, kind of
filthy,
stultifying type place.
Everything, yeah.
All the things. And I really fell in love with it and spent all my time just kind of walking around and visiting different sites. And the one thing that kind of gave me a little bit of pause that I feel like I couldn't fully put myself into the city was my Jewish identity. It was the beginning of the First Intifada, and I was, you know, I didn't feel particularly comfortable telling people that I was Jewish, whether that was founded or not. And then one day I'm wandering around a neighborhood called Coptic Cairo or Old Cairo, and I come upon these gravestones in a cemetery, and I kind of look more closely and I realize that there's Jewish names on the gravestones, and some of them have Stars of David. And, you know, I kind of wander a little further and see the synagogue that these gravestones are connected to. And I kind of listened in to this tour guide talking about 1,000 years of Jewish history in Cairo. And that I hadn't really known much about there being a Jewish community in Cairo because there wasn't in the year 2000 much to speak of. It really struck me that Jews could have lived in this place for 1,000 years, and there would be very little remnants of that. And so I kind of became obsessed with the Jewish community of Cairo, and you know, many years later, that led me to write this book.
We will talk much more with Michael David Lucas. He's a very interesting guy. It's a terrific book, The Last Watchman of Old Cairo, when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, just across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., and this Saturday, Shavuot evening services are at 8 p.m., along with the Tikkun Leil Shavuot study session. And in the morning at 10 a.m., we'll have Shavuot Yisker services. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great Hebrew school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest growing at its exciting beginning. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to KohanAward.com, KohanAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is KohanAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are pleased to introduce a pretty new feature of Too Jewish, recurring at least twice so far. It's called Three Truths My Grandmother's Talmud Told Me. Three Truths My Bubby's Talmud Told Me. It's always a bad hair day when you're bald. Two, always whisper the names of diseases. And three, there comes a time in every man's life when he must stand up and tell his mother he's an adult. For Jews, this usually happens around age 45. That was Three Truths My Bubby's Talmud Told Me from Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or ekvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, recently returned from abroad. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you had a trip to kind of the heartland of Sepharad, Morocco, Spain. Tell us about it.
Well, it was a very interesting trip in many ways. We had a few people who were quite observant of the Sabbath and the dietary laws, and a few people who were less observant, and one woman whose family was thrown out of Spain in 1492, and she is more than 90% of the way toward completing the process of acquiring a Spanish passport and Spanish citizenship.
Which is available now to people of Jewish extraction.
Well,
I mean, sort of Sephardic background.
If you jump through a lot of hoops.
Yes.
And also available from Portugal.
Right.
Not clear which country has more hoops to jump through or why people would necessarily want those passports, except that both countries are in the EU and having an EU passport is or can be quite useful.
Right.
So I'll just take this in chronological order because even though the people traveling with me were highly educated and well-traveled, very few of them anticipated the amount of interrelationships that they would find between these two great cities in Morocco, Fez and Marrakesh, and three great cities in Andalusia, Granada, Cordoba, and Sevilla, down to the point that the houses look the same, the hotels look the same, the decoration, the mosques, the architecture, the food, the language. There's a lot of influence in both directions. The Muslims and eventually largely Moroccan Muslims were in Spain for almost 800 years. And a lot of people who fled Spain for many reasons over the last, let's say, 400 years of those 800 ended up in Morocco. So there was influence in both directions. And what was interesting to me is what's left of Jewish life today. I mean, basically every city in Morocco has a well-preserved Jewish cemetery, several well-preserved synagogues, in some cases Jewish schools, whatever, that are no longer in use, but that are maintained and guarded by somebody. And if you give that somebody a little bit of money, you can visit. That is not the case in Spain. In Spain,
right,
these old synagogues have been transformed into churches, and there is no semblance of a historic synagogue that is still a synagogue, at least in this region of Spain that we visited. So first, I think I want to talk about Morocco, where there's a more lively contemporary Jewish community than there is in Spain.
Yeah, which is remarkable.
And then I'd like to talk about Spain.
Sounds good, and it sounds like we might have a few weeks of talking about this.
I hope so.
They had, there was a Jewish community, a great Jewish community in both places for a very long time, and we'll have a few weeks to explore it. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The children of Israel wait at the base of Mount Sinai. You can hear only a subdued murmur among them, but you can feel the tension in the air. For hours now, Moses has been on top of the mountain, hidden from their gaze by clouds wafting around its top. Sometimes the clouds become dark and thunder rolls down. In spite of the warm weather, this causes a shudder among the waiting mass of Israelites. The end of the day approaches. Dusk is setting in when suddenly a bearded figure descends through the clouds, climbing down the steep mountainside carrying a heavy load. It's Moses. He sets down his load and raises his hands. "Friends," he says, "friends. It was hard work. I have done my best. I've negotiated with him. I used every possible argument, every trick I could think of, and I think I was successful. The good news is, I brought God down from 15 to 10 commandments. The bad news is, adultery is still in." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniyot, our representatives of Israel, young stars, Rotem Rapoport and Ron Benekot. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So a lot of the pieces that we've been seeing in the news for a long time have involved the area that you guys are from, the area just to the east and north of Gaza, in Israel proper, and many of the attacks have been experienced by communities, either your communities or the communities just like you all along there, in terms of balloons being floated over with incendiary devices, kites, and of course rockets landing and then attacks on the fence and sometimes people digging tunnels under, and all of that's happened where you guys are from. So I thought it might be valuable today, we all did, that you talk a little bit about your experiences.
This experience of living in that area really gave me a lot of ways to handle this situation. I also think that obviously sometimes it can interrupt with the way we live our life, but most of the time we really do, you know, just have like a normal life. And the thing that I most excited about is to be in the Army in a few months and hopefully to get like a different perspective about it, maybe get to be in that area during my service and protect that area. I think it's going
to
be nice.
So in other words, to have the opportunity to protect your home.
Yes. That's what I feel that I
should do. Which is something that, you know, most militaries talk about, but for Israelis who are serving in the area of the South, it really is exactly that. Rotem, your experience, your observances.
So,
observations, sorry.
Yeah, for the last 10 months, we've been here away from our families and our home. A few weeks ago and a couple more incidents throughout the year, there were some tough times where we live. I think it's really, really hard to experience. I think it's more hard for me to experience it here than to experience it there, because I feel like when I'm there, I can see what's happening, and it's like, for me, it's not that bad, because I'm used to it, just like Ron said, and I'm with my family. But when I'm here and I'm hearing about it, like, I know my family and my friends are there, and I just can't do anything about it. And I text them all the time, like, really anxiously, trying to figure out. And they're like, it's fine. Like, don't worry about it. You've been here all this time. You know it's fine. But for me, like, I can't see it anymore. So I really don't know what's happening. It's way more harder for me to see it from here than from actually being there.
You know, this is a funny analogy, but I grew up in Los Angeles where there's lots of earthquakes. Every now and then there's a giant earthquake. And when I lived there, I was never afraid of earthquakes because they, you know, you get used to it. You know that they're going to happen. They're not a big deal. The way they're reported elsewhere scares you. And I always call my parents and I'm always panicked. And if I can't get through, I think something terrible's happened. And they live in an area which is unlikely to really have any problems and so on. But you just never know.
Yeah,
right?
You're just, because like, you know in yourself that it's not that bad, but because you're not there, you think it's worse.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah,
like,
it magnifies
exactly.
It. Yeah. It's so funny, you know, when you're in Israel, you don't think about those things much. You really don't.
You don't. And it's really, I don't think, I always hear from other people that like don't experience, even people in Israel that just don't live in that area. They always say like, how are you not scared? How are you, you know, like not nervous about that? And I guess we're just got used to it. Like Rotem said.
Well, people are incredibly adaptive. And I think the Israelis living in places like Sderot, I mean, are, you know, they're used to so much, and yet they have normal lives, successful lives. And you guys are testimony that not everybody is a victim of, you know, terrible post-traumatic stress disorder that comes out of there. You know, you're warm and wonderful people.
Hopefully.
I think so. Thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Litrot.
Litrot. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its English name by the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. The Hebrew name for the portion and this book, Bamidbar, means in the wilderness, while the name comes from the very first words of the book, as usual. It has a greater resonance and meaning than simply its lexicographical location. It also speaks of place in a unique and powerful way. Every time we Jews seek inspiration, it seems, we must head out into the desert. It was true of Abraham and Jacob. It's certainly true of Moses. And after the Exodus, it's true as well for the whole people of Israel, who wander for 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, Midbar Sinai, seeking God and revelation. Why must we head out into nothingness in order to find truth? Perhaps it's simply because our lives are filled with complications and complexity, which seem critical during our daily grind, but mostly turn out to be truly unimportant. Until we leave behind the conveniences of home, until we divest ourselves of comforts and conceits, we are unable to really understand what truly matters. Faith blooms freely in the desert, for there is nothing to prevent a person from seeing the world as it really is, and coming to understand God's amazing role in it as creator. You too can find God in the wilderness. This is just as true in the Sonoran Desert as it was in the Sinai Desert for our ancestors. We simply need to look for God, away from all the complications of daily life. The poet asks, "Must we enter the desert to hear your voice?" To which we might answer, "Yes." But we must go out into that wilderness willingly. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Michael David Lucas, will explain what motivated him to write about the remarkable Jewish community of Cairo and the secrets it has retained for centuries. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In disturbing news, nearly 28 years after the Aryan Nation's Idaho compound was demolished, far-right extremists are maintaining a presence in the Pacific Northwest and expanding it. White nationalism has been on the rise across the U.S., but it has particular resonance along the Idaho-Washington border, where the various neo-Nazi groups, including, well, especially the Aryan Nation, espouses hate and violence and has done so for years. The neo-Nazi group was based near Hayden Lake, Idaho, starting in the 1970s. Eventually, it was bankrupted in a lawsuit brought by local activists and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Its compound was seized, its supporters dispersed. But a series of incidents in recent weeks show far-right sentiments never really left the region. In a county that's home to Hayden Lake, for instance, Republicans last month passed a measure expressing support for the U.S. entry of a prominent Austrian far-right activist who was investigated for ties to the suspected New Zealand mosque gunman. In 2018, at least 9 hate groups operated in the region of Spokane in northern Idaho, including Identity Europa, Proud Boys, Act for America, and America's Promise Ministries. This is according, again, to the Southern Poverty Law Center. The center does not track exactly how many members belong to each group. Keegan Hanks, a researcher for the Southern Poverty Law Center, said the number of hate groups is growing across the U.S., driven in part by our crazy political culture these days. The human rights group counted 784 active hate groups in the U.S. in 2014, but 1,020 in 2018. White supremacist groups particularly are growing because of fears that the country's racial makeup is changing. That drives a ton of anxiety, said Hanks. These new far-right activists are more scattered than the ones who used to gather at the Aryan Nations. It is no longer necessary to go to a compound in Hayden Lake, Idaho, said Christine Hoover, director of the Gonzaga Institute for Hate Studies in Spokane. With a proliferation of social media, groups form in dispersed locations. Gatherings are more covert. In late April of this year, a self-described American nationalist named Brittany Pettibone appeared at a meeting of Kootenai County, Idaho Republicans asking for help to bring her boyfriend, Martin Sellner, to the country from Austria. Pettibone said Sellner wants to marry her and live in Post Falls, Idaho. Pettibone was a big promoter of the hoax known as Pizzagate, telling her online followers that Hillary Clinton and others were involved in satanic rituals and child sex trafficking tied to a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant. Sellner is a leading figure in the extremist identitarian movement, which espouses a white nationalist ideology and has swept over Europe amid an influx of immigrants and refugees. Sellner confirmed he exchanged emails with the suspected New Zealand shooter who donated money to Sellner's group. Despite this background, the Kootenai County Central Committee passed a resolution urging the federal government to allow Sellner into the U.S. The resolution said the government revoked Sellner's travel privileges for political reasons and demanded those privileges be reinstated. Faced with criticism for giving Pettibone a platform, Kootenai County GOP Chair Brent Reagan blamed the press. In its lust for scandal, the media has stretched the committee's simple act of kindness into headlines that are too bizarre to be fiction, he wrote in a recent op-ed in a newspaper. Also last month, a newspaper published internet chats from 2017 in which a Washington state legislator and three other men discussed confronting leftists with a variety of tactics, including violence, surveillance, and intimidation. These messages prompted Washington House Democrats to demand that the Republican lawmaker, Representative Matt Shea of Spokane Valley, be reprimanded for a history of far-right speech and activities. Shea did not propose violence, but he did not speak up against violence when it was proposed. Also in Washington, House Republican leader J.T. Wilcox responded that Shea shouldn't be punished before investigations are completed. The House, led by Democrats, is conducting an independent investigation of him. Shea has served in the Washington State House since 2008, introducing bills to criminalize abortion and roll back gun laws, and pushing for Eastern Washington to secede from the state. Military veteran attracted international attention in 2018 after a document he wrote laid out a biblical basis for war against people who practice same-sex marriage or abortion and instructed if they do not yield, kill all males. In a third case, a nationwide arrest warrant was issued for a Stevens County, Washington man just this month, a man who allegedly tried to extort members of his right-wing militia group through anonymous written threats backed by insinuations they came from a Mexican drug cartel. James Russell Bolton faces at least six charges of extortion and attempted theft after he was arrested recently in West Virginia. He led a militia group called the Stevens County Assembly, also in Washington State. Stevens County detectives believe he was responsible for a series of anonymous threatening letters delivered to members of the group. They purported to come from a Mexican cartel and demanded large sums of cash in exchange for protection. However, it is a mistake to consider all the above as separate incidents, says the Gonzaga professor. These are movements, Hoover said, noting participants are not doing this alone. They have interconnectedness over the internet. In other news, a fire that started in the Ben Shemin Forest in central Israel burned down the Mavo Modin community founded by the late Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach. It is suspected of being an arson attack. The fire was one of more than 1,000 fires that burned throughout a very hot and dry Israel last week. Israel's Fire and Rescue Service initially blamed the blaze on faulty electrical wires, but has since discovered it has several points of origin, suggesting arson. 40 of the 50 homes that make up the Carlbach community burned down, as did 10 homes in the adjacent community of Kibbutz Harel. Although this disaster has befallen us, Shabbat is sweet and gives us life, said Alan Tiger, chairman of the association that runs Mavo Modin. The way people of Israel opened their hearts to us brought me to tears. I did not cry when my house was burned. We hope they rebuild soon. That's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Michael David Lucas, has had really quite a career for a young guy, a Fulbright scholar in Turkey, a night shift proofreader in Tel Aviv, student at the American University of Cairo, which we began to speak about earlier in the show, and a waiter at the Bread Loaf Writers Conference in Vermont. I'm not sure if that qualifies you an author or not, but maybe by osmosis. His first novel, The Oracle of Stambul, was a finalist for a California Book Award. His second novel, The Last Watchman of Old Cairo, won the National Jewish Book Award, the Sophie Brody Medal, and the Sammy Rohr Prize. We started speaking a little bit about Cairo itself, which is such a fascinating and overwhelming place. Of course, the Jewish history is really deep and rich, even though you weren't aware of that when you first went there. When you began to research it, what led you to kind of connect it in this kind of picaresque, novelesque way?
Yeah, well, so I started, you know, as soon as I kind of found out about this community, I started reading everything I could get my hands on. And a lot of what's written about the Jewish community in Cairo revolves around this this depository of documents called the Cairo Geniza, which is in the attic, or, you know, what's called the attic of the Ben Ezra Synagogue.
It was really kind of a side chamber. They threw stuff over a wall.
Yeah,
kind of transcendental.
It's often called the attic, so I sort of stuck with that. I went back and forth with a colleague of mine about whether we could call it the attic or not.
Yes,
but regardless,
it's okay.
It's sort of a metaphorical attic. There's this prohibition against throwing away documents that have the word of God, the name of God, or may have the name of God on it, as you know, and as many of your listeners probably know. So often communities will bury these documents, and sometimes they'll put them up in Geniza, in the synagogues that are inside the synagogues. And for whatever, meteorological reason, this particular set of documents survived for more than 1,000 years and was, quote-unquote, discovered in the late 19th century by, there was a series of people who kind of partway discovered it, and then Solomon Schechter and these two kind of globe-trotting British Victorian millionaire ladies also assisted Solomon Schechter in kind of unearthing these documents, and then they brought them, most of them, to the Cambridge University Library. And that kind of drama around finding and, kind of taking the documents serves as, one of the kind of linchpins of the book. The other plot line is set in the 11th century when the synagogue was rebuilt. And then there's a plot line that's in the sort of cusp of the 20th, 21st century, which is when I lived in Cairo. So I felt like I needed to, bring in a little bit more of a present day perspective.
The hero of this story, Al-Raqib, I'm not sure, my Arabic pronunciation is pretty bad, but it's
passable.
Okay, thanks. But it basically means shomer, right? It means guard or watch person or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like someone who is watching. And the reason I chose that for the character's last name is that, it's this kind of honorific, right? It'd be like someone being named Goldsmith or someone being named Shomer. And I like that. And I also appreciated that it was, there are these lists of God's names in the Muslim tradition. And on one of them, or on many of them, this name Al-Raqib comes up. And I liked that it was like, one of God's names and also could be applied to humans. And that was actually the original title of the book, was the 43rd name of God, kind of getting at, And I also appreciated that, it's a Jewish tradition too, to sort of like enumerate God's different names and the different attributes that are kind of associated with those different names.
So, a Geniza is really, it's sometimes been called sacred trash or sacred treasure or whatever. It's documents that somebody doesn't want anymore. It happens to have God's names. You throw it away. But when you begin to dig through it, of course, you find secrets. And I think the discovery of both secrecy and identity is a big part of your novel. Can you explore that a little bit for us without revealing too many secrets?
Everyone in this book is trying to figure out who they are, as is everyone in the world. They all are kind of drawn to this particular place, the synagogue, and in particular the Geniza that's in the metaphorical attic of the synagogue. So in sort of digging through these documents and in, interfacing with these documents, they come to kind of understand themselves in a more kind of complex and deep way. And so that's part of the idea. I don't want to give away too much, but
no spoiler alerts here.
No spoiler, but the present day plot line starts off with that character, Joseph, getting a mysterious piece of paper, a mysterious document from his father after his father has died. And he never really felt connected to his father. He grew up in California, and he grew up in New Mexico, and his father lived in Cairo. And so, you know, he's sort of spurred on by the by the arrival of this document to go to Cairo and actually investigate his father's side of the family. And I should say, his father is Muslim and his mother is Jewish. And so he's got this kind of, you know, you could say tension within him, that he's very much aware of, but, you know, he uses this as an opportunity to kind of explore the connections between those two different communities.
So I have to ask, how much biography is there in this for you?
You know, I think that with any novel, all the characters are some sort of manifestation of yourself. I kind of think of writing a novel as being like that scene from Being John Malkovich, where he goes into the restaurant and everyone has
his face,
his own face.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, some characters are more sort of like closely aligned to your own biography than others. And Joseph in particular was difficult for me to write because he is so similar to me in a lot of ways. He is in his personality, in his sort of mindset, you know, where he lives. But in other really important ways, he's quite different. My dad is not Muslim. He was born Christian, and Joseph is gay, and I'm not. So those are the sort of two big, you know, demographic type differences between me and Joseph. And what was difficult was just feeling so connected to Joseph, and feeling like, okay, Joseph's like this kind of, you know, parallel version of my own story. But what really allowed me to get into his head was actually sort of taking a step back from him and allowing him to be his own person.
It's fascinating.
Allowing him to sort of like bloom as his own self and be like, okay, I'm connected to him, but he's also his own person.
You know, I've always been fascinated by the Geniza, just such an interesting window into the life of an important Jewish community 900, 1,000 years ago. It's also fascinating to think how different it is and then the ways in which it's similar. Were there any surprises as you began to play with those ideas because you know, you move from one to the other?
I mean, there's these sort of like very tangible, concrete things that were surprising. Like, oh, they had, you know, sewers in, you know, 12th century Cairo.
Yeah, they might have worked better than the sewers do in contemporary Cairo.
Who knows? And they were performing, you know, glaucoma surgery. Like they were doing eye surgery at the hospital there. And all these sort of like technological type tidbits that I gleaned.
One of the most advanced places in the world in that period, if not the most. You know, it was an important place.
Definitely. And the Jewish community was
cutting
one
edge.
Of the most important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so that was interesting. The other thing that's sort of like a main theme in the book is just what it means to live in a multicultural society, and what it means to, you know, have neighbors and friends and people who you're interacting with on a daily basis who are different from you. There's a lot of differences. You know, it was much more kind of like ghettoized than I imagine most American Jews experience their lives in, you know, 2019. And yet at the same time, a lot of those same conflicts and tensions and, you know, concordances and harmonies that I kind of experienced in my own life were I think, resonated with some of the experience of Jews in that 11th century plot line as well. And that was something that I sort of like had in my mind from the beginning, but it was interesting to look at that, you know, how those fears and also those connections are not that different than the experiences that we have today as American Jews.
I had an interesting thought. Well, it's interesting to me. Thought, is your book going to be translated into Arabic? I kind of hope so.
I think it is. Yeah, it just I think it just sold to a publisher there, and I mean it's available in Cairo, and there's a lot of people in.
Well, they know English. Many people, right?
In Egypt, who know English. So there's that, but I think there is something different about it being in Arabic, and what that means, and you know the types of people who are able to sort of like read and like to read in Arabic versus those who like to read in English. So I'd be interested to see what the response is, and I know that there's a sort of nostalgia for that multi-ethnic past these days, because, you know, they're sort of like inching more and more away from that over the course of the 20th century. And so it would be interesting to see whether, you know, what it is about the book that people resonate with and what it is about the book that they don't like. Who knows?
It'd be fascinating to see. Yeah.
Yeah, as I found in English, too. It's like you never know what people are going to sort of like and what they're going to take issue with.
Well, as they say, it's like a child. You send it off. And the responses
exactly.
And its actions are not necessarily what you expect. Michael David
exactly.
Lucas's book is called The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. Where can people go to find out more about you?
Gosh, you know, they can go on the internet. I have a website, Michael David Lucas. My last name is spelled Lukas, .com. And, you know, I think that all over the place. That's where I would start.
Start with your website and work your way around.
Exactly.
Thanks for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And I don't need to tell you good luck on this. It's already off to a flying success. I don't want to say start even. It's done really well. It's a terrific book. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be the distinguished author Francine Klagsbrunn, author of Lioness, Golda Meir, and the Nation of Israel. Our playout this morning for the holiday of Shavuot is the slightly ridiculous song Stay Up All Night about the Tikkun Leil Shavuot from a group called Rebbetzin Tap. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavuot Tov, a good week, a Chag Sameach for Shavuot, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The 6th of Sivan, it's the day that we receive on.
Anything you want to learn, it's alright.
Put some water in the urn.
Stay up all night.
Put on your fedora. Time for Kabbalah Satorah. Anything you want to wear, it's alright.
Just keep those thumbs in the air.
Stay up all night.
Chomesh Chazara,
Mishnah Chazara,
Gemara Chazara,
yeah!
Eat a melon or a mango when you do the Torah tango.
Priya Adama or Eitz, that's right.
Got to make it tonight.
Stay up all night.
Say some prakim of Tehillim. Keep your coffee cup from spilling.
If you're starting to sway, it's all right.
Try our cheesecake buffet.
Stay up all night.
Navi Chazara,
Musar Chazara,
Halacha Chazara,
yeah! So wake up your chavrusas. This is no time for excuses.
Anything to help you focus, it's alright.
Cause there's really no machlokis.
Stay up all night.
Hold on to your shtender. We can't possibly surrender.
Cause you know it is Shavuos, that's right.
And the only thing to do is
stay up all night.
Cause you know it is Shavuos, that's right.
And the only thing to do is
stay up all night.
Gonna stay up all.
Gonna stay up all.
We're gonna stay up all night.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.